view. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank not only the organizers for inviting me, but all of you for enduring so long in this session. I'll do my best to get you quickly to lunch. Now, the title of this, the topic we are discussing is emerging powerhouses. And then we usually think of countries like China, India, Brazil, and so forth, all very populous countries. And this is the reason for my title, Can Small Nations Compete in Education and Research? Now, what is a small nation? I don't think there is a UN or any other international agreement on what is small and what is big in terms of nations. So I have arbitrarily chosen a limit of 20 million population. Now, the countries with fewer people than this represent less than 10% of the world's population. But over 75% of the independent and autonomous nations in the world. So as long as education and research are mainly subject to national decision-making, these are the important nations quantitatively. Now, capacity building has become a national strategy in many, if not most, of countries. And why? Because competitiveness in knowledge economy depends on a well-educated workforce, research base to foster innovation, and an enlightened population. Recently, the strategic focus in many countries has also been on developing universities. Why? They want to achieve an edge in skills and competencies of the workforce. The universities are responsible not only for their own sector of education, but in effect, the whole education chain, because they train teachers throughout the chain. Also training researchers. And nations want to have research excellence to out-innovate their competitors. And the final reason for bringing universities to the focus are ranking lists of universities, global ranking lists, which have become quite widely popularized over the last decade. As a result, universities are currently considered as instruments of economic and social policy in many countries. If this thinking is taken too far to the entrepreneurial sense, I think we are doing a great disservice to the nature of universities. But this would be a topic of another sermon. It is easy to understand why higher education is considered in the context of economic success if you look at relationships like this, where higher education attainment on the horizontal scale is graphed to GDP per capita, and there is a linear relationship, which of course does not tell anything about causality, but indicates that there is something in higher education that is desirable. Now, the European Union wants to become the leading knowledge-based economy in the world, and even though they have no mandate in educational matters, they want to advise their member nations how to deal with the so-called Lisbon Agenda to promote this goal. And the important elements of this are the realization of the knowledge society, and as an important element in that is the modernization of universities, in which the European Union has given a number of papers for member states to follow. Also, setting R&D as a first priority and setting a target of 3% GDP investment into research and development, which already was done in 2000 and still remains in the books. But capacity building is a long-term project. And I'd like to illustrate this with my experiences from my own country, Finland. Actually, the first significant effort at capacity building in Finland happened in the late 19th century, when a law was passed that you could not get married if you could not read. And this caused a great increase in school enrollment and also a great increase in adult education, mainly operated by the church, because the clergymen then had to take on the often very mature and often not so a population not so conducive to learning, to teach them the alphabet. But that at least taught the people that it is important to be able to read, literacy is to be valued. Our comprehensive school reform dates back to the 1960s, 1970s. It covers the whole country. It is homogeneous, and there are no special schools to speak of. They are very inclusive also to learners who are not actually up to standard. We try to keep everybody in the same school system. Teacher training happens in universities. All of them have a master's degree, including those who teach in kindergartens and nursery schools. In response to a severe economic crisis in the early 90s, when the country was near bankrupt, the response was to increase investment in research and development. The universities suffered in the same era with a 16% cut in university budgets, but the R&D, the competitive research budget, was increased and led to a fairly quick recovery from the recession and also an increase in scientific performance. Our new university law is fairly new. It increased the autonomy of universities and changed their legal status to independence. There are a number of problems if a nation wants to design higher education and research and development policy. One is that the targets are almost always input related. You can set a target of investment on as a percent of GDP. You can set a target for cohort participation rate, attainment levels, and so forth. It is much more difficult to measure the outputs and have them as the targets of a policy. For example, learning outcomes are very, very difficult to measure, particularly at the tertiary level, and also research achievement is not so simple. And even more difficult is to evaluate the impact of measures in higher education and research, because it takes a long time before they become apparent. How they influence the innovation system and economic progress, and most important, how do they influence human well-being in the nation? And so often, promotion of higher education and research is more a matter of faith than facts. Some numbers about the educational attainment of EU countries. This is the red line is the target that EU has set for tertiary educational attainment among those aged 30 to 34. This is in the 2020 strategy of the European Union, and it's a 40% attainment rate. It is already exceeded by quite a number of countries, most of them small countries. And this kind of a target is much more difficult for large countries than for small countries. If you look at the national expenditure per student in higher education as a function of the GDP per capita, which is on the horizontal scale, there is generally an increase in investment in higher education with the increase in the economic success of the country. But there is no evidence that putting money would directly influence the outcome of either education or research. I have not found evidence for this in tertiary education, but certainly if you look at primary and secondary education and how the performance of students is related to the investment that the nation puts into it. Here is a graph that shows the performance of each country in the so-called PISA assessment, which is an OECD assessment, where 15-year-olds in each country are tested for their skills in reading, mathematics, science, and so forth, and a score given on a national basis. And on the left side is the PISA performance of countries in reading, and you see there are Korea, Finland, Canada, and so forth, in decreasing order. Now, if these achievements were dependent on the investment in education, which is on the right side, then you would expect a mirror image of the left side, high investment, high performance. But in fact, there is really no correlation between these two. And looking at it, educational spending related to the PISA success correlation plus 0.18 in effect, no correlation, that's a shotgun figure. And it shows that in education there are other and perhaps more important elements than money alone to drive quality. What about R&D investment? This shows the development of the investment in many countries, in a number of countries. And as you can see, Israel, Sweden, Finland, Korea have already exceeded the 3% target that the EU has. Unfortunately, the scale is very unclear. But these countries already are there. Again, looking at how the on a national basis, how the national wealth on the horizontal axis correlates with scientific achievement measured as citation intensity. There is a rough correlation. The more wealthy the nation, the better the scientific performance. But there is already a group of small nations that distinguish themselves: Switzerland, Sweden, Israel, Finland, Denmark, Netherlands, the UK, that do actually better, more efficiently in their scientific endeavors, as their wealth would indicate. And you can show with many indicators that if you use the per capita way of expressing achievement, small countries do extremely well. This is the number of scientific publications: Switzerland, Sweden, Israel, Denmark, Finland. Number of patents: Switzerland, Germany, Finland, Sweden, Netherlands, so forth. The same countries come out in front in most instances. And this perhaps is the reason why the World Economic Forum, when they make their global competitiveness index, these same countries are usually close to the top. Whether there is a causal connection or not, that is not proven, but anyhow, some indications are that small countries actually do extremely well as long as we measure their performance per capita or per GDP. But there are certain other measures where small countries simply cannot compete. One is the share of 1% of the most highly cited publications, which is an indicator of the most important science being produced in the world. And you can see that still the United States has a lion's share of these, and small countries, they do figure, but with much, much smaller weight than in the per capita evaluation.
Mr. Raivio, we have to close the session, please.
Yeah. Also, in the university rankings, they are dominated by USA, UK, small countries shown here have a few universities there, but very few. And that is mainly because the researchers and the research institutes do not eat GDP percents. They eat dollars or euros, and so the total amount invested is more important than the percentage amount. And here the USA, Japan, Germany are still very dominant. Also, Nobel Prizes. If a young person wants to get a Nobel Prize, it is better to move to the United States or move to Israel and do chemistry, because Israel really is the small country that does best in this. So, some of the dilemmas that that small countries face are illustrated in this figure, where you can see that China will graduate about 8 million young people from higher education annually which is more than the whole population of these small countries. And so my conclusion is that small countries are very efficient on a per capita basis, but financial and intellectual resources limit the breadth of science that they can undertake, so they have to concentrate their resources, find their special advantages, and collaborate. And concentrate on quality, because quantity-wise they will never do well. And also there are collateral benefits of capacity building, which are indicated here, in the adults satisfied.
Mr. Weidel, thank you very much. We should close the session. Thank you very much.